Y'all want your name on it, right? Right, guys? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Got a quorum.
Yes.
Thank you. Call the meeting to order. First, Mr. Cook, you have to take the mic.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A public notice of this meeting containing all items on the proposed agenda has been filed in the Office of Secretary of State as required by Chapter 551 Government Code, referred to as the Open Meetings Act. I would like for this fact to be noted in the official record of this meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Cook. We'll start out with the Finance Committee. Chairman Horn.
Fishing licenses for the year. Those of you who have been at this table for several years recognize that in years past that was always a rather exciting event. Sometimes to be known not exactly when we're going to hit the ground or when we're going to take off. But thanks to our staff, particularly in Mary's shop and in George Reel's shop, and in their work with the people at Verizon, we have continued to smooth that process out. Those licenses went on sale that morning on a statewide basis, and I have not heard one blip. Now, I see some folks in the audience who I'm pretty sure know some of those little bumps, but it has went well. It's off to a great start, and I appreciate everyone's efforts on that. In the same connection, as you know, we started about a year ago looking at the issue of the pending deadline coming 2 years from now of our current contract with Verizon. George Reels and his crew, again Mary and her staff, we looked at potentially taking that process in-house, building our own system. We went out and talked to other companies, other organizations. We've been in constant communications with other states. What we arrived at, and I reported to you back a meeting or two ago, in fact, that we were then went into a discussion with Verizon about amending their contract and extending that contract, which currently expires August 31 of 08. We've been in a discussion with them for the last 3 to 4 months, a pretty serious discussion with them. And it appears at this point in time that we will amend and extend that contract with Verizon for our license point of sale system. The extension, some of the key points that from my standpoint and I think from the agency standpoint, we keep our current pricing structure, which is 76 cents per piece, which is a bargain in today's market looking at what other systems do. It increases the annual support hours that we get from Verizon, from their specialist team, from 300 hours to 600 hours. It takes care of some system requirements that we need to get done to satisfy auditors and our staff. And possibly most importantly, it replaces the old Hypercom units that we currently use with thin client max speed equipment, which all ties into the network. This equipment and technology, we believe, is definitely a step in the right direction and where we want to take our license sales in the future. So that's where we are in that process. Looking at a 5-year extension would carry us to 2013. And if we continue to get the kind of service at the price we're paying, we believe that is the best of all options. Finally, we continue to work with the various auditors to review the aspects, all aspects of our financial systems. Our internal auditors just recently finished up a follow-up audit on payroll and personnel issues. They found that most of the recommendations that had been made had already been taken care of, remaining recommendations in progress. They found that overall our payroll and personnel systems are functioning well. The state auditor's office, as part of their statewide audit, will be auditing for federal compliance in our research and development grants. They have started to gather their information for this audit. Finally, the Comptroller's Office has contracted with a private firm to do a third-party recovery audit. This audit searches for overpayments or duplicate payments to our vendors, and the private firm seeks recovery of those overpayments if they find any. That audit should start within the next 2 to 3 months, and we'll keep you posted on the progress of those audits. That's all I have, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Cook.
Yeah, Bob, does our contract extension with Verizon allow us the flexibility to have both simplified sales over the Internet and to go paperless if we choose to within that time frame of 5 years?
Within that time frame, I don't, Commissioner Montgomery, I don't think we see that as a possibility. The contract can always be amended if we see that opportunity. This contract, and I'll ask Mary or any folks to correct me if I'm wrong, this contract does not make a marked change in, in other words, where you can call in now and get the number and go hunting to be followed up with a paper license. It does not include or envision a change to that extent.
Would the amendment require a significant price penalty for us, or are you saying we have the flexibility by amending the contract to achieve those objectives if we wanted to do that?
I believe that would require a change in price based on what we hear.
Sure, change in price, but not. But the question is whether it's a big penalty.
Mary?
We would have to pay for hours of programming beyond the 600 that we know for 4 hours of the program. Any major changes we would make to the system, we need to work with them to see what kind of hours it would take and what the cost would be.
Does it leave us captive with them as a sole source provider if we go either Internet or choose other subcontractors to provide those other services different ways?
I can't answer your question right now, sir.
We've had a lot of discussions about providing flexibility going to the
room. And we haven't found a way to do that, I guess would be my honest answer to you on that.
Yeah.
We have not found a way to do that under current.
And take this lock in for 5 years and lose that flexibility if that's what's happening, rather than preserve the flexibility.
I don't think this contract necessarily locks us in. I mean, right. I think we could make some changes. I think we could, but it will be costly. It will be very costly if we do so, I think.
It sounded like we were getting some advice.
I don't think we're really locked in as far as the technology. I think as long as the technology continues to develop, which is what we're trying to say with, we'll continue to work with Verizon on the delivery of how we should do that. And I think we'll do that for the life of the contract. I don't think it pretty much locks us out. If we see some technology there and we look at how we can simplify the licenses, I think what we'll do is work with Verizon through this contract and see how we can deliver those. But that probably will change the contract or probably will change the base cost. But right now, we've got to.
George, identify yourself for the record, please.
Do I understand that right now you still get a license for bird hunting, small game, right off the Internet with your individual ID number or off the phone?
Yes.
With a credit card?
Yes.
So pick up phone, credit card, you're done. It's only big game tagged.
Well, and that would be your paper license would be fulfilled, would be provided.
Right, but you could go hunting. I mean, the scenario that I'm always asked about is the person who is either an infrequent or new hunter or just got their certification from out of state to be able to pick up the phone, as I did once in Nebraska, did my credit card, had a license and went virtually. That afternoon. Now we can do that. It's just big game we cannot, right? And something, you're not going to have your bird stamp.
You don't have a tag.
You're not going to have a bird stamp. You can't go bird stamp.
No reason you couldn't have paid for it.
I think the number, correct me if I'm wrong here, Kim, come forward, Kim. Or somebody who can speak to this. The number that you're going to get will verify whether you bought a super combo or a, you know, whatever particular type with stamps with all of that sort. Identify yourself and help me out here, Kim.
License manager. Yes, as long as you don't need your tag for the big game, you can go bird hunting.
So you can go bird hunting.
Can you do that online?
You can do that online.
And get a confirmation number?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Or by telephone.
Or through our call center.
And going into the new contract, that's not going to change.
That's not going to change.
There's no change in that.
But the call center is no longer 24 hours.
Correct.
It's
Monday through Friday, 9 to 6.
Okay. And the reason is obviously funding, I would guess.
Correct.
Expensive. But the internet is 24/7.
Correct.
I think we have one constituent who would like to pay the difference so we can have that 24 hour.
Commissioner Fink and I have heard from that constituent.
He needs that 2 a.m. call.
Before 6 p.m. Well, again, for the volume of licenses and folks that we deal with and the availability through the internet 24/7, the availability by phone, I think we're there.
Yeah.
So we don't think we're missing sales or anything like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, is this the first year we haven't been on phone? I can't remember.
Well,
our call center phones are only about 2% of our business, and have been. So
I think we haven't been 24/7. Is this the second year?
Second year.
Yes.
Any just rough guess of the cost savings or the cost if you were to go 24/7?
I don't know that. Okay. I don't believe we've ever been 24/7 on.
I think we were like the first year. So I think we were.
Yeah. But over the years, it's decreased down to where it is today.
Right.
May I follow up on that? Excuse me. 2%. Is that 2% of all licenses?
Yes, sir.
So it's 50,000 licenses.
Yes.
Handled by the call center. That's an active call center.
Mm-hmm.
Are we giving up going paperless?
I believe in this cycle, we have given up going paperless.
Okay. I mentioned at a previous commission meeting that one option could be down the road, that we would, just like we get a permanent driver's license, that we could get a permanent Texas Hunter number, whatever number that be, and have that reflected with a plastic card with a picture, and then annually, just like you renew your driver's license, you could renew that. And I would assume that our game wardens could access that number and know whether you had a super combo or whatever. And I don't know whether any other state does that, but if we did that, then we could automatically submit it back to the hunter, and maybe we wouldn't have people drop through the system. In other words, we would take the initiative to say, by the way, your renewal based on last year's license would be X number of dollars. Just a thought, but I don't know if that's way out in left field. But if we did that, then you would have a permanent, just like a driver's license, a permanent hunting license, which you could renew or not renew annually. I'll just throw that out. I mentioned that before.
I had convinced myself that sort of as a customer service that paperless was a good objective. I
mean,
I've never studied it. I haven't come up with solutions, but are we sure we're ready to make that move and give it up by locking into 5 years? Everybody's clear the thing to do?
Well, I mean, it was studied very, very, very in-depth throughout the agency. From the agency standpoint, I think that the major concerns are law enforcement issues, follow-up on animals that are in coolers, in camps, in possession of someone else, the need for that tag. You know, you could go paperless except for that need.
I don't disagree with that.
We have guarded it very, very closely. Interestingly, when you bounce that off of most landowners do not support going paperless.
Mm-hmm.
And from a law enforcement standpoint, we believe that it is necessary.
From also, many are still trying to work out protocols over the long term with Texas Animal Health Commission on the CWD issue, and I think until we're really sure where we are on that, that might be something to consider.
If I understood it, this doesn't preclude going paperless. It just is a system that does not currently, is not currently structured to go paperless. So if some some technological advance occurs in the next year or two or three, this contract could be expanded, I presume. Isn't that what I heard you say, George?
Well, we have to work with Verizon, just like with any other technical solution. There's probably going to be a cost, and that cost is going to be just in the contract, and we'll have to work with the agency. That's
yeah.
This contract will allow
us to do. It wouldn't be without cost, right?
Well, my understanding is there are states which are paperless now, and there are technological providers, multiple ones, who do provide internet-based systems. It's a question of, I've always thought it was law enforcement and then the safety issue. So
there are states that are paperless.
Yeah, yes. I mean, it's out there. It's not a question of whether it's out there. It's a question of whether we choose to use it.
Some of those states, you know, and Commissioner, some of those states, for example, that are, quote, paperless as far as the licensing system, require that the hunter put some sort of document mm-hmm. on the animal. Hence defeating the whole purpose right. of being paperless, in my opinion.
It's still not
paperless.
It's still not paperless. Claimed paperless.
Some states, again, depending on how they're structured, get away from it completely in most game birds. But a few even on big game. But they almost all of them require some sort of document to be with the animal.
Mm-hmm.
And from our standpoint, it would appear to be the most efficient thing to do just to provide that document in the process. But
we have a little to look. I figure we can pay for the field is just to make it easier and more available to buy a hunting license.
Yes.
The whole reason I keep bringing it up. No, thanks. Okay.
Thank you, Kim.
Any further questions for Mr. Cook?
Item number two, financial overview. Mary Thiebels and Bob Cook.
Good morning, Commissioners. For the record, I'm Mary Thiebels, Chief Financial Officer. I've got several items to cover with you this morning. I'm going to start off with the financial overview for 2006. The focus of this presentation is to provide a revenue and budget status through June 30th and to give you our annual update on the progress of our business improvement plan. Let's start with the revenue and budget status. With State Park receipts, gross receipts through June 30th at $27.2 million, we are up 5.8% or $1.5 million over last year's collection. In reviewing the categories the park received, all of the categories exceed the prior year at this time. Facilities and concession revenues are up slightly. Miscellaneous revenue is a smaller category on there, but it is up almost 20%. The big revenue increases are in the entrance fees that are up 8.7%, and park pass sales are up 22.7%. So, we're doing well in that category. We've really tracked well all year with the pass sales.
Did we increase the fees at the gate coming in?
There were a few park fee increases at the beginning of the fiscal year.
22%.
Our boat revenue as of June 30th is at $15.9 million. This is down by 2.1% or $347,000 compared to last year at this time. We've really made a lot of headway, though, in this category. Y'all will recall in the last meeting I was reporting through March, we were 10% behind here. So in the last 3 months, we've gained quite a bit of ground. So I'm actually pleased with this progress. With the water levels and gas prices, we kind of expected this revenue category to be down a little bit. In the specific categories of revenue, boat registrations are down by 4.3%. Revenue for titles issued is up slightly, and sales tax revenue is up by 6.7%. We continue to transfer 15% of registration and titling revenue to Fund 64, and that amounts to $2.1 million based on the revenue freezing. Our license sales revenue is also just slightly down. This has been tracking fairly close to that for the past several months. At $82.6 million, we're down $1.3 million in revenues as compared to last year, or at 1.6%. Combo revenue is down by 1.8%. Fishing is down by 5.6%. Hunting is slightly up at 2.2%, and the other categories up by 3.5%. In comparing these numbers to more recent sales, I did look at the report as of August 9th, and again, we're pretty close. We're at 1.4% behind, or 1.2 million down, and that's pretty close to the close of the year. Even with this slight decline we're seeing, we still exceeded our revenue estimates, so we're in good shape with the license sales. In reviewing the number of licenses sold at 2.6 million, we're down 0.3% as of the end of June. Hunting is down 3.1%, and that, as y'all recall, does not relate to the revenue category because we had a lot more non-resident licenses were sold. And that's what drove that revenue up. Fishing is down 6.2%. Total combo sales are up 3% when compared to last year's sales. That includes those military super combos, that number. So those are the licenses sold.
Do we have any research on why we're seeing declines in hunting and fishing? Because that's why I keep bringing up paperless and everything else. I worry that we've got declining usage.
Well, remember,
is that purely from super combo sales? Is it continuing to affect the super combo, or is that including?
What does that number mean?
If you recall, the Katrina Rita effect in September put us way, way far behind, particularly in fishing.
Yes.
And we've been closing that gap. At one point, wasn't it, Mary, we had about 14 or 15%. And so we've closed that gap ever since then, but we've just never been able to catch up.
But remember, Katrina Rita happens when people buy their licenses in August and September. So
I
hope it's not a long-term trend.
Extrapolate that. Let me speak to this, too, because Commissioner Montgomery's concern and question is certainly one that those of us who are in the business and in the profession have watched forever. I don't have, as far as research, yes, there's a lot of people who have looked at this thing in different ways. Fewer people are hunting. Fewer people are fishing. The structure of the licensing system, if you look across the same states, the structure of the licensing system, there's no indication that there's a system out there that is not suffering the same impact.
Oh, it's very broad.
And you know, we've looked at that pretty closely because there are different licensing systems out there. You know, some of them very, very piecemeal, some of them very, very combined. Our super combo thing being one of the most, you know, easiest access to everything. And frankly, that does not seem in any form or fashion to be driving license sales up or down. It's an area to watch. It's an area to always look for convenience and ease, but we have not found any indication that there's a problem in our licensing system that's keeping people from buying a hunting and fishing license.
It seems to be driven
much more by other age and or time factors.
Demographic issues are there, but those of you, and you'll remember, those of us been on the commission 4 or 5 years, we had a study presented to us maybe 4 years ago about where we lose hunters and fishing. Mm-hmm. And what, you know, the message there was that you lose them just to net it out between the time that the parents quit taking the child and paying for everything and the time that person has got their own job and their own family. So you really lose them between 18 and 27. And so we looked at addressing that through the certification, Hunter Ed issue, which I think we've made some progress on that, but by no means should we give up on making that more of the debate was, is it a barrier? I don't think it's a barrier, but I don't think it's as much of an attractant as it could be to draw people in. And frankly, you know, not to turn every conversation to state park funding, but the fact is a lot of people get their exposure through our state parks to fishing. And we've
we've, with the leadership of Bob and inland fisheries and licensing people, we've instigated that new plan with fishing without a license for free in state parks. But that's really, it's a demographic challenge, and there's that gap. And correct me if I'm wrong, we reversed the slide of the 80s and 90s. I wouldn't say reverse. We slowed the decline.
Yes.
I'm always looking at Gene for this. All right, Gene, help me. Slowed the decline, didn't reverse it, but it is a long-term demographic trend.
What's interesting there is if you look at the total number of licenses sold, it's a negligible drop, 0.3%. But then when you look at your revenues, there's a substantial drop. So can I conclude from that that we're really not losing fishermen or hunters, but for some reason, maybe they're not buying the combos or... But, you know, you look at the combo and it's up 3%. So that I'm trying to reconcile...
What's going on there, and we maybe should do a little bit different presentation in the future. Included in those combo sales are the military super combo licenses, which we are not charging for. There's about 35,000 of those in there, which equates to, you know, roughly $2.2 million of revenue.
Which we really have not received.
That's right.
Okay, because that may be what distorts it, because if you look at it and you see that total number sold, you say, well, that's negligible, 0.3%, that's really not much. But then you look at the revenues and you see down, and that's where I was having difficulty.
We do count it technically as a sale, but there's not revenue. What I could do is pull that number out and footnote it or something, and that would maybe give you a truer correlation of the revenue to the sale.
Because if you look at that, we're really not losing hunters or fishermen, I don't believe.
Not in actual numbers, but in percentage of the population.
Yes.
We're getting behind in that measure.
Yes.
Is there an issue of non-resident in the revenue? You made a comment about that.
There is an issue about that with the number of hunting licenses sold is down, but we've sold more non-resident licenses, and there are a lot more revenue than...
I wonder if we couldn't help footnote that a little bit, too. That's another issue we have, is how do we market folks out of state and then versus in-state? Because in-state is where we're losing.
Yeah, and I think our challenge is once that person buys a license, be it a hunting or fishing license, and they're, quote, in the system, we need to ensure they stay in the system, and it seems to me that our licensure should be designed to facilitate their renewals rather than have to take an initiative. You see what I'm saying? In other words, once in your system, you're always in the system unless you elect to be out of the system, as compared to you're in the system for a year and then you're out of the system unless you take some affirmative action. In other words, maybe more of the initiative should be on our part as compared to the consumer.
Sounds like a marketing initiative, well, more so than a license.
Yes, because some people just, you know, I don't want to...
We're talking about the lapse, what they refer to as the lapse hunter. And that was another category they showed us. Who did that study for us? Was it... That was, right, 3 or 4 years ago. But they had a category of lapse hunter, which is what I think you're talking about, the person who... 100 years, then doesn't, and then never quite comes back
into the system.
And then when they're about to, it's just not. They haven't been reminded,
right?
So to speak, you know.
Commissioner Parker had a comment.
Speaking about this, and this is, I realize the great benefit of having this year, last year, the benefits of the information of this year, last year. But Gene McCarty, I asked Gene McCarty a few months ago to draw me up, you know, being a little bit older than the rest of you, I like to look back and because, you know, if you don't know where you've been, you don't know where you're going. So I asked him to make me up a list of licenses sold, both in units and dollars, for the past. Gene,
where are you, Gene? Was that 10 years?
No, it's more than that. 20. was 20, yeah.
First it was 10, then it was
10. Yeah, yeah, then it was 20.
I told you that. I
knew you were
right. Right,
no,
right.
What are you?
We weren't even born yet.
We're still taking
it. Anyhow.
But we had 10 years in the government staff, and that was easy to get. Then we went to 20, which was a lot harder.
Right. Yeah. But anyhow, it wound up being 20 years. And I would like to throw out on the table a proposal that every commissioner get to see those that graph, and then Mr. Chairman, Ned, I would like for you to think about that and see if we really need to talk about that, because there's some there is a concerning trend there that I think it is our responsibility to take a look at.
I did the same thing during the great catfish debate last spring when you and I were on different sides of the question. For exactly that reason. I did the same thing. I don't always take myself seriously. But I did the same thing, and John's right on target. There is a very concerning long-term trend. That's why I've taken some sometimes contentious sides on some of these issues. We have a fundamental problem. That's why I stopped this on this. I do think your point, we really ought to step back and look at that as a marketing proposition and think about how we organize our activity, because we do a lot of little things that make it a little harder a lot of places for good reasons, and we just need to realize part of this is making it easier for people to do, and part of it is a demographic shift out there. I won't talk about it too long, but Mr. Parker's on to something very fundamental, and I know we've talked about it. I don't know if we've done all we can, but I think the department and Bob have made huge strides simplifying what we have. Great, enormous progress. It's been very good, but I think we've got to keep leading and pushing in that department.
How can we further enable the process?
What did you say, Dan?
How can we enable it and facilitate the process?
Make it easy for people.
Make it easy for people.
We will provide that information in detail, and absolutely we welcome the commission's deep involvement in it, because it is an important issue.
What you're going to see is that for the past 20 years, without a few spikes, like when we had the great idea, whoever that combo deal was a great idea, but other than a few spikes, you're going to see those numbers as flat as this table in front of you. And it is difficult to take it to the next level of how do we not only make our this recreational idea of hunting and fishing more attractive to people, and how do we do that, but the other thing that we need to start thinking about is how can we continue to provide goods and services at today's prices when we're still only receiving income other than a few little spikes of 20 years ago, both in numbers and in dollars. Numbers of people and dollars received from those people. You know, that's something that I think we need to begin to look at. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I think it's a good point, because it's not just how many you sell, it's not just what the revenue is, but it's what that relationship between the two is.
Yes, because you think about all of the increased costs, and those increased costs didn't happen this past year or the year before. They didn't happen. They've been inching up forever.
Right.
It might be a good idea to ask Bob and Mike to show us that study again that was paid for and was conducted that addressed this issue. I think it was before you were on the commission, John. And it's enlightening. And one of the really troubling things you're going to see from it is that we're losing It's not just the inability to bring in new customers. We're losing the existing, the people who are the sons and daughters of existing men and women who hunt and fish. That is a challenge.
In pursuing the goal of finishing this in the same day we started it.
Move ahead. When comparing our 2006 revenue collections as of June 30th to the annual revenue estimates, we're progressing as expected in all of the funds. With 83% of the fiscal year elapsed, our actual revenue collections are where they should be. Now, on Fund 9, typically at this time of the year, we would show about a 92% collection rate. But we are behind a little bit on some of our federal draws, which are basically reimbursements. So if you take that out of the mix and just look at our true collections for licenses and boats, we're at 93.4%. So we'll continue to watch this, but I'm not concerned. We've got 83.9% of our state park funds received. The local park fund is ahead at 101.2%, and the other categories at 72.7%. In reviewing our 2006 budget versus expense, you can see where the budget is at $321.7 million, and we have $114.8 million, or 35.7% of the budget remaining, with 83% of the fiscal year last year. The salaries and related benefits are basically on track, but our spending on operating is behind. I looked at a couple of prior years just to see kind of where we were at this point in time, and we were usually at about 30% at this time. So we're running about 5% behind the norm in our operational spending here. But we do have the increased gas and utility costs that we'll be incurring this summer, and I think we're going to catch up very quickly with these operating expenses. We're also showing, as you can see, there's 75.9% of the capital project funding that's still available. And when I'm talking about the 2007 operating budget, you'll see that quite a bit of this is going to be carried forward. The unissued bonds that you see there relate to the East Texas Fish Hatchery. We're not going to issue those bonds until 2007, so we'll be carrying that authority forward. Overall, our budget has increased by $4.9 million since March 31st. Budget adjustments were made for April, May, and June are summarized on the slide. The most significant adjustments this reporting period are for the grants, and there were actually numerous grants added over this period, so I'm not going to highlight any one specifically. And then there's over a $2 million adjustment relating to Rider 9 and Rider 26. Rider 9 is it's a construction and landowner incentive grants and basically local park construction grants, and we did bring in a pretty sizable grant for our rec trails and trails grants. So that's what the majority of that is. The Rider 26 portion is fairly minimal. That's where we bring in additional capital equipment and funding. If the feds say we can spend the money on capital equipment, then we carry it in and we can exceed our limits. So business improvement plan, y'all recall we just report on that annually now, and since last August we've completed two more of the tasks. The two that we completed, basically one of them relates to the contract monitoring issues relating to our point of sale license system. And the other one relates to federal funds coordination across the agency. So those two recommendations have been totally completed. The remaining five outstanding items relate to our revenue systems. Basically, they're wanting to see us integrate those systems and interface them, and it's going to take us a while to get all of that accomplished. Currently, the plan takes us out to November of 2008, so we'll be talking about these last five items for the next couple of years. So that's it on the financial overview. On the operating and capital budget, we'll get started there if there's not any questions. Today I will recap the budget process, discuss how the budget is financed, provide a couple of summaries of the budget,
recap the budgeted full-time equivalents, or I'll be calling them FTEs, review our capital budget, and then wrap it up with a couple of key points. Let me just start off by saying, for the most part, our process for preparing the operating budget is similar to prior years. Also, since this is the second year of the biennium, we're basically carrying over several of the same issues that we had in 2006 or are still there for us in 2007. As our starting point, we started with 100% of our 2006 base budget, and via Rider 27, we added our revenue contingencies, and we anticipate that the controller's office will certify at least the same amount of revenue as they certified in 2006, so we built that revenue contingency into base, and you'll see a little bit more about that. As in past years, each division built their budget requests, and they prioritized and justified all their programs. The only additional budget that we allowed them to add were requests where we receive additional funds that come with its own authority, those things like the federal dollars and the donations. This next item is a change from prior years. We did not budget salary lapse this year to meet budget demand. You'll recall that salary lapse is generated when the budgeted positions are vacant for a certain period of time. And in the past, we estimated our vacancies, and we budgeted some of that up front, and then we catch up throughout the year. We elected this time to not start off with a salary lapse in the budget.
I want to speak to that one very briefly. My perspective, that's betting on the come too many times. We will have some salary lapse. We know that with vacant positions that are funded. But to budget that up front, in my opinion, is it's risky. It restricts your ability to have some flex during the year. If, again, you get a Katrina or you get a something like that that happens to you, you have some needs. And it eliminates, by booking that lapse up front, it eliminates any opportunity for you to come in mid-year and make adjustments as needed. And, you know, you're talking about probably a 3, 4, 5% lapse number that we talked about, and that's a few million dollars. It's not a lot. But that gives us an opportunity to look at issues, like, say, if we have something come up that we need to focus on, that we need to point some money to solve, to answer, to address. We have that option. If we want to look at something like merits, one-time merits for outstanding employees, it gives us that option in mid-year. So that's something that we've been trying to get to, and I appreciate all the division directors and their commitment to go there. It has not been easy. We have notched down on it each year, but we are there in 07, and I think it's a very wise move.
I agree with you, Bob. Could you, on Rider 27, could you remind me how much money that amounted to when it was authorized this last
budget? It's a total of $8.5 million. 4.9 of it is Fund 64, and 3.6 of it is Fund 9 million. One other change here from the prior year, that last bullet, we did make the decision, since our capital line items are so small for an agency of this size, we did go ahead and take them to the 125% maximum at the beginning of the year, and we'll talk more about capital as well in the presentation. So let's review how the budget was financed. We start with the amount of appropriations that we received from the legislature via the General Appropriations Act. And for 2007, we were appropriated $197.7 million, and then we billed from that amount. The Appropriation Act also includes limits on the amounts we can expend for capital items, and we are capped at the amount of FTEs that we can have. There are also numerous other restrictions on our appropriations that are highlighted in the agency-specific riders. We have 30 of those rider provisions, and we consider those as we build the budget. As I mentioned, we're in the second year of the biennium here, so many of the highlights we discussed last year are also applicable this year, so we'll run through them quickly. This slide has the additions. You'll recall we received $18.1 million of Prop 8 bond authority for construction and major repairs. Any funds we don't expend in 06 will be UV'd or carried forward into 2007. UBs or unexpended balances. So we also received $2.1 million for repairs to the San Jacinto Monument. There may be a little bit of carry forward on these funds, but most of that will be spent in 2006. We've received $15 million of revenue bonds for the East Texas Fish Hatchery. And as I've mentioned, that authority will be carried forward into 07. We are still working with TxDOT and the federal government on the $16.1 million for the battleship. I've already mentioned the contingency rider. And finally, we received another 3% pay raise in 2007. That amount is added to the 4% raise that was received in 2006 for state employees. As far as the reductions occurring over the biennium, you'll recall we took the 5% reduction, which resulted in divisions cutting their budgets last year by $2.6 million, back carry forward, and local park grants were cut by $5 million. We also absorbed an additional $2.1 million for longevity, hazardous duty, and reclassification salary increases that were not funded by the legislature. And as you know, our strategies have grown from 10 to 29, and our ability to transfer funds has been cut in half, basically, to 12.5%. This does limit our flexibility to move funds around. We haven't seen this as a major issue, except really in the one strategy relating to construction, and that's a capital line item with a 25% transferability limit. This 12.5 gets into conflict with us, so we will be addressing that in a rider request and our appropriation request. And finally, we were limited in our land acquisitions to the amount we had available at the end of 05, and we moved about 1.7 over into the biennium to spend, and we'll be using some of that. This next slide basically crosswalks our budget as it starts with the General Appropriations Act, and then we make those adjustments to get to our total operating budget. Again, we started with $197.7 million. There are various adjustments I'm going to cover that get us to the total of $295 million. Commissioner Fitzsimmons asked about Rider 27. There's that $8.5 million coming into the budget that we talked about. We are applying the increases for the employee pay raises. That total is $11.1 million. We do estimate our benefits replacement pay and our benefits, and we set the benefits portion aside for the employee's retirement system. We're carrying forward unexpended balances. These primarily relate to construction and land acquisition, and we'll talk about that more a little bit later. We're adjusting our estimate for federal funds. We are decreasing that amount because we estimate these a couple of years back when we do the request, and we don't actually pull these into the budget until we have signed grant agreements. So we will be receiving more federal funds throughout the year, and you'll see me talk about those in budget adjustments.
But those, Mary, those come with their own authority, right?
Yes, they do.
And, which means it sort of automatically increases.
That's correct. This is no real loss to our budget at all. We'll as they get signed, we'll bring them in, and there's no problem doing that. Finally, there was a slight adjustment to the amount that was transferred to the Texas Historical Commission relating to the transfer of the Admiral Nimitz Museum. So that takes us to the $295 million. This next slide is just a view of our method of finance. We earn close to 50% of our funding with Fund 9, our Game Fish and Water Safety Fund that has the hunting and fishing and boat revenues at 36%. And Fund 64, our state park revenues, are there at close to 12%. The remaining funding comes from general revenue at over 18%. Bonds and other funds are at 14.5%, and federal funds are at almost 19%. Let's move on to just a couple of different ways to summarize the budget. This first summary gives a broad overview of our budget by object of expense. I've included comparable totals to 2006 up there. Salaries are up as expected due to the 3% increase in pay, and you see the corresponding increase in the benefits. When you consider those two items together, we do spend over 50% of our budget on our employees. Our operating expenditures have increased over 2006, primarily to cover the utility and gas costs that we've been talking about. Grants are down some, but they're fairly comparable to the prior year. The debt service increased in 07 due to the debt service that's appropriated for the revenue bonds associated with the fish hatchery. And the capital budget includes the 125% of the line items and the unexpended balances for construction and land acquisition. The next couple of slides highlight our budget by division. You see the division's budgets in millions and the percent of the total agency budget, just to give you a sense of the size of each division. And this is how the agency really operates. Each division has a detailed budget that they manage, and you know, so this just kind of lays out where the money goes. And I'm not going to cover all the numbers on the slide. I will point out that the administrative divisions that support the entire agency only amount to about 11% of the agency's budget. So it's pretty lean for administration. Spend a lot of our money on our resources where it should be. This next slide just shows more program divisions, and it's no surprise here that state parks and law enforcement carry larger percentages, primarily due to the number of FTEs that they carry in their divisions and they're operating. And in your package, I believe Carol handed out an action item package for tomorrow. You'll see in there I have an Exhibit A of our agency's budget by strategy. I didn't include that on slides because there's 29 of them, but that's really how the legislature views our budget, so you may want to take a look at that exhibit. And then the second exhibit, it actually shows our agency's divisions by by object of expense, so you get a better sense of how each division is spending their dollars. And there's also FTE counts associated with the divisions on Exhibit P. We'll be asking you to approve those tomorrow. Moving ahead to recapping our FTEs, want to just highlight our reductions over the biennium, just to more clearly show the impact of our FTEs. They have been reduced by 137.5 since 2005. In 2005, they were capped at 3,038.5. Then we took those operational reductions to 5%. That ended up eliminating 59.1 FTEs. There was another mandated 2% reduction by the legislature for most of the state agencies, and that was another 60.4 FTEs. And then we transferred those FTEs relating to the minutes. So we're capped at 22,901, and that's the same cap we have in 07. As far as budgeting those FTEs, in 06 we budgeted 2,936.8. We have increased that by about 20. We're up to 2,956.1. And then you see our cap. Now, we can budget above the cap because we don't keep all of our positions filled. And we will be tracking that closely throughout the year to make sure we don't exceed the cap overall. They do allow us to blend ours quarterly because we have a pretty big peak in the summer.
Make an important point there, Commissioner. We have consistently done this through the years, budgeted slightly above our cap for planning purposes, and we have never yet ever exceeded the cap, and we will not.
Okay. Here's that capital budget. As I mentioned, the Appropriations Act includes our capital budget limits, and they show up in Rider 2. And again, we made the decision to increase those amounts to the maximum allowed. So the first column on this slide is just showing those capital line items at 125%. Two of our capital line items, the land acquisition and the construction and major repairs, those include unexpended balances or UBs, and you can see those balances in the second column. The construction UB at $44.5 million, that includes several components. It's the $15 million we talked about for the fish hatchery, a good portion of the $18 million in Prop 8 bonds that were appropriated this biennium for construction and major repairs. There's some carryover of previous bonds issued and a few other funding sources that were approved for construction. And then the last item column gives you just the total budgeted for each item. We do fully anticipate contracting the majority of the construction funds during fiscal year 2007. and just contracting them effectively encumbers or obligates those funds. So you shouldn't see this type of balance at the end of 07. However, we will carry some forward into 08 and 09. And I'll wrap up my comments about the operating budget with just a few key highlights to recap quickly here. Again, those reductions in 06 continue to impact us in 07. We based our budget on 100% of the base plus the revenue contingency rider. We do not budget salary lapses. We raised our capital limit. We applied the 3% pay raise. We continue to absorb those inflationary costs for utilities and gas. You have to remember, when we built this LAR a couple of years back, gas prices were about a dollar cheaper than they are now. So pretty good impact to us. And again, we're going to encumber those hatchery bonds as well as the other, the majority of the other construction balances. So that completes my presentation on the 2007 operating capital budget. I'm going to move on to the next item, which is a high-level overview of our 2008 and 9 legislative appropriations request, or LAR, as I'll refer to it from this point forward. We did finalize it, and it was distributed by our deadline of last Friday, August 18th. And here's the document. I believe you gentlemen will be receiving a copy. So that fine document is a lot of effort. I'm sure you're going to read each and every page of it.
Put it under your pillow.
I do. It is a tremendous effort. And before I start, I really do want to thank the budget staff, Reggie Pugues, our budget director, and the staff there, as well as all of the division budget coordinators throughout the divisions that really worked with us this year. And we coordinated was definitely a coordinated effort. So let's take a look at what we've got here. Today I'll discuss how our base budget was established, review the general revenue and general revenue dedicated 10% reductions that were required to achieve our base and the related impacts of that, and I'll review our exceptional items and then just summarize the total request. In establishing our base budget, we estimated the amount of 2006 funds that would be expended. We included our 2007 budgeted amount, and then we applied the required 10% reduction to the general revenue and general revenue dedicated amounts. And then we added our estimates of those other funding sources, such as the federal and the appropriated receipts. The required 10% general revenue and, let's see, I think I just lost my place. Excuse me. There we go. The required 10% general revenue and general revenue dedicated reductions totaled $14.2 million annually. $7.9 was reduced from our Fund 9, the Game Fish and Water Safety account. $2.5 million was reduced from Fund 64, our State Parks account. Less than $33,000 was reduced from Fund 467, our local parks account, and a little bit from our Fund 5004, which is our capital account. And then $3.8 million was reduced from general revenue. For a total of $14.2 million, that's an annual number. So in applying these reductions by those funds that I just covered, you can see that the divisions and the local parks took a good portion of the reductions, and I'm going to talk about those impacts on the next slide. Other reductions in Fund 9 include cutting our shrink buyback program basically in half. It went from $2 million down to $1. Reducing our capital construction by, again, almost half with another million reduction there. We eliminated $400,000 that we were holding to improve our financial system. And we applied a 10% reduction amounting to roughly $400,000 to the fees that are paid to our license agent. So that's the recap of the annual reduction. These impacts that were applied, basically the impacts include substantially reducing our local park grants by roughly 45 grants and eliminating two FTEs. We've eliminated 52 game wardens from law enforcement. We've imposed further reductions and closures of our state parks, along with the elimination of 44.43 FTEs. There's more FTE reductions of 7 in the resource division and 6 in the infrastructure division, along with additional operating reductions.
And finally, six more FTEs from the Administrative District Division and further operating reductions there. So the governor's office wanted to see the impact. That's the impact along with the programs that I discussed on the prior slide.
This is what we do. This is what we're showing them. What happened to them?
That's correct.
We're at a point, Commission, where, you know, obviously, I say obviously, we can't reduce fuel anymore. We can't reduce our utility bills. We're going to have to pay those utility bills, and all of those are increasing. We take a reduction. Most significantly, it's going to come out of FTEs at this point.
Yeah. Let me make a little clarification about this, because there's been some, I think, misunderstanding, confusion. That there's two stories out here. One of them is we're reducing by 10%, and this is what's going to happen. And the other, that with the governor's support, I appointed this state advisory committee to help us look at ways to meet our stated goals. Those aren't two different stories. Those are completely different exercises. One is the exercise, what would happen if you took a 10% cut. The governor's office at the same time said, come up with a plan of what it takes to meet your stated goals from where you are. So the 10% cut is an exercise. I think it's accurate to say. Wouldn't you agree, Ned?
Yes.
There will be a rest of the story.
Here it is.
It's a question. What would happen here? Yeah, there you go. Good timing. Yeah. And you really have that plan.
I'm asking for it right.
Did you know
back.
That plan was next? Yes, you have that plan with John and the rest of the story.
We are actually that first priority exceptional item is to restore those reductions. So there it is.
This is for the biennial.
These are biennial totals. Thank you, Commissioner Halls. So I just switched you from an annual total to a biennial total here. And you'll see that throughout this slide. Our second item requests $170.9 million over the biennium again to provide adequate funding in an additional 262.7 FTEs for state parks and support functions as recommended by the State Parks Advisory Committee. Our third item requests $46 million of Proposition 8 general obligation bonds over the biennium to fund the major repair projects. You'll recall those Prop 8 bonds were approved by voters in 2001. This is the last piece of those bonds that was designated for us.
Mary, I think it's worthwhile to point out number 2 and number 3 are in absolute sync with the State Park Advisory Committee's recommendations that you'll be hearing about tomorrow.
Our fourth item requests $5.2 million of general revenue over the biennium to fund game warden operations. GR funding is requested there because game wardens are spending more time on homeland security and other duties that are not related to fish and game law enforcement. So we do need some general revenue. Our fifth item requests $18.1 million over the biennium from freshwater fishing stamp sales to fund the remaining construction of the East Texas Fish Hatchery and maintenance and repairs to other hatcheries statewide. The sixth item requests $22.5 million in 2009 to complete construction of a permanent dry berth for the battleship that will again be part of a long-term maintenance solution. And finally, our seventh item requests $11.8 million over the biennium to fully fund operations at the Texas State Railroad. And this includes 61.7 additional FTEs. So those are our exceptional items. In reviewing our total request for fiscal years 2008 and 9, the base request amounts to $409.2 million. Those exceptional items total $302.9 million for a total of $712.1 million over the biennium. That's our request in this book. If there are no questions, I will move on to the final segment here. Annually, we are required to review the budget and investment policy. A copy of these policies are included in that action item handout for tomorrow's meeting. There have been no changes to the budget policy, so I'll touch on just a couple of key points. The Commission authorizes the Executive Director to approve and execute necessary expenditures, budget adjustments, and transfers.
Several different types of transactions are detailed in the policy. Budget adjustments excluding the federal grants and the bonds that exceed $250,000 require prior approval from the chairman of the commission and the chairman of the finance committee. So those are the highlights on that one. Moving on to the investment policy. Again, this policy has not changed since the prior year, but as the governing body of this department, you are required to review the policy annually. All funds administered by Parks and Wildlife are required to be deposited in the state treasury, except for the four funds that are highlighted on the slide. While not required, all of them actually do reside in the state treasury, except for the Operation Game Thief Fund. Those are invested in CDs and several separate bank accounts. Did take a look at that. It looks like there's about $325,000 distributed in several accounts. All of the bank accounts that we're talking about must be authorized by the delegated investment officers and must be properly collateralized. There are specific reporting requirements that are also included and detailed in the policy. And that concludes my presentation. Are there any questions?
Any questions for Mary?
Thanks for your hard work.
Yeah.
Make it a little lot easier.
Yeah. I second that, and I tell you, this has been an interesting process for us to get to this point, as you can well imagine. One that we're very, very careful with. We're working with very hard, and I would be absolutely remiss not to express to each and every one of you staff's appreciation for your support, your involvement, and continued work as we approach a very, very important intersection here in how we're going to do business at Parks and Wildlife.
It's going to stay interesting.
I think you might be right.
At least through next May or whatever.
Mr. Parker.
The thing that encourages me the most is the wonderful support for the rest of the story from the governor and the speaker. I think those people are in it with us for the long haul, and I really think that we should give credit where credit is due for those people stepping up to the plate, those two people stepping up to the plate and saying, yes, we've got to have these exceptional LAR items.
I wholeheartedly agree, and I would add Harvey Hildebrand into that as well.
Mm-hmm.
He was carrying legislation for us. And we need all the help we can get. Because it's going to be a tough session. Are there any further questions or discussion about Mary's presentation? If not, I will place the FY07 operating and capital budget and the budget and investment policy resolution section of this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Item 3, technology update. Mr. Rios.
Commissioners, for the record, my name is George Rios, Director of Information Technology. I have two items to present today, and we'll start with the data center consolidation project. This is a huge and complex project that affects a number of state agencies. This project will have a sweeping effect on the delivery of technology services, staff, operational procedures for procurement of goods and services, and could potentially impact us financially. A quick recap on the legislation's intent for this project. To maximize the value of technology investment, the 79th Legislature passed House Bill 1516. The legislation directs state agencies to take a statewide approach on the delivery of data center services. For reference, data center services are a type of equipment that we generally refer to as mainframe and server-based equipment that is housed in what we call a computer room. What this is are these are those boxes for security, for internet hacking availability. They're the boxes where we store data. This is our email, our financial systems, all the boxes that run the back-end systems and applications for the agency are considered part of the scope. It also includes the staff that manage those systems. The overall goal of this legislation is to reduce the cost through economies of scale improve security, and disaster recovery capabilities for all state agencies. The selection of the top 27 agencies involved was based on technology spending patterns for the delivery of data center and associated services. The handout that I passed you lists those 27 agencies, including TPWD, in no particular order. Legislation instructed that the Department of Information Resources is responsible for the project and the project selection of the service provider that will provide these services for all state agencies statewide. Currently, there are over 30 data centers across the state with varying levels of security, disaster recovery service. Most individual agencies have contracts with different terms and conditions for these related services. The goal is to move to a shared environment and a common infrastructure. The state will have two data centers rather than 30, higher levels of security and disaster recovery service, and a single contract for economical pricing and flexibility of services. Bottom line, what this does is within this project, it initially, the service provider takes over the equipment that's in our computer room that we're currently managing. But over a two-year period, or maybe a little longer, what will happen is all of that equipment that's in there will actually move to one of these data centers. So it's going to impact us from that standpoint. It's in the vendor's interest to do this and consolidate this as quickly as possible to recover his initial cost on this. Agency involvement through this project, I serve along with the other affected IT directors on an advisory council, which is a data center advisory council that DR created soon after the legislation was passed. And what this council does is DR wants to seek information from all of the IT directors and the agencies. We meet frequently and actively on all aspects of the project. In addition to IT and IT staff, we have HR staff and administrative resource staff that have given their time to serve on these committees. These work groups' main goal was the development of the requirements for the request for offer that was going to go out, and now it's through the evaluation of the responses that have come back. Over the past year, a large amount of time and effort has been given from our technical folks with extensive data collection and validation required for this project. I mean, for example, what this means is that for every computer or every server that we have in that back computer room, we've had to get the number of processors, the amount of memory associated, the systems, the applications that run on them, the contracts that are associated, and we've done this over that process in order to submit this information to DIR. To give you a little update on the milestones and where we currently are, we've completed several of these. The big one, or the one I'd like to mention, the data collection that was due December 2005. What this basically did is this was the base case for what it cost this agency to provide those services. That was submitted back in December of 2005. Right after that, we started working through these committees and groups in order to develop the request for offer. And we also had to sign an interagency contract. And the interagency contract was part of the legislation that required all agencies to sign. And what this did is it was what set the terms and conditions in which DIR would deliver the agency services. The request for offer was released in March, and the vendor responses were due in May. DIR did receive two responses to the RFO. Primary vendors with associated firms, each representing many of the top firms in the industry. The two primary vendors are IBM and Northrop Grumman. Our current activities are the evaluation of the responses, which we started back in June, that are going to go through October. Due diligence, this is the piece where the vendors are going to have a chance to come in and true up the information that we have submitted. In fact, we have vendors here today, and we'll have vendors here tomorrow. What they're going to do with this process is this will give them a chance to come in, look at the agency, the services that we provide, verify what those services are so that they can go back and do a better job on providing a best and final offer. The best final offer is still on schedule for October. Everything is, according to DIR, is on schedule for a contract signing late November, early December. And once that contract is signed, we'll start moving into a transition and commencement period. The transition period is basically between December and March, and this is where we'll meet with the selected vendor or the awarded vendor, and what they'll start doing is working with each specific agency in order to get a better understanding of the systems that are managed in that computer room so that they can actually take over those services. And they'll take over those services, which is the commencement on March 31st. That's basically the way I look at it, is we basically turn off the lights that night when we leave, and they'll turn them on the next day. From a financial impact for the agency, the cost associated with the delivery of services is still unknown and will not be available until the contract is signed. Since our IT division runs exceptionally lean on the delivery of these services, there's an outside chance that even if the state sees the savings as a whole, that this agency may not realize a cost savings and that it may actually cost us a little more than what we're currently paying. This is an outside chance, but because of that, we've instructed DIR of our concerns, and DIR did agree that if it does cost us more, that they would work with us through the legislative appropriation process to seek those funds. We also addressed federal funding-related concerns in our LAR administrative statement to ensure that if the increased funds is needed, it will not impact us or impact our federal funding partners. This is a hard one for me.
I guess have you gotten to that point yet? How they're going to decide how they're going to allocate those bonds?
No, sir.
Okay. Yeah, financial risk.
We're hoping that through the process, and especially sometime between the November-December time frame, that we'll be able to get a little better idea of what those costs are going to be for the individual agencies. That's when we'll know. DR has instructed us, and I think they're working with LBB, that when they return those costs to the agencies, that we'll be able to adjust for funding needs if it's needed there. From a personnel standpoint, we have a number of affected staff. When we talked about the data center consolidation earlier, I mentioned that it was not only equipment, but it was the people that manage those systems. When we submitted the information, which is what I would call the in scope of what is within a data center and the support, we identified 9 positions whose job functions will move to the center. What we're doing is part of the requirement of the RFO is that the selected or awarded vendor is required to offer at least a 1-year minimum contract to all individuals that are affected. This is across the state. And why they're doing that is really for a benefit of reducing the amount of risk that is associated with moving these systems over to a new vendor. We obviously have the in-house knowledge. We obviously know how to manage these systems. And what they want to do is ensure that this transition is smooth, that there's no harm or issues to the services that we provide. And they realize that. And DR, more importantly, realizes that it's important for us as state agencies to work with them for the success of this project. One of the things on here which we've been concerned with from the get-go, when the legislation was passed, it's really the flight risk. There was a number of staff that once the legislation was passed, they knew they were in scope. In fact, within the IT operations area, there's 20 folks. All of them have some portion of their job responsibilities within this in scope of services. At that point, we started working with HR on the affected employees, and to this date, we do have 9 positions that are going. 2 of them are made up within the IT division, and 1 of them is made up by a portion of FTEs throughout the agency. The loss of institutional knowledge is another one. We've been strategizing on how to ensure that we've gotten the documentation and the requirements needed to run these systems so that none of our systems are affected through this.
George, before you move away from that,
yes, sir.
Back on the flight risk, you said we know that there are 9 positions that are going. We also said that there are 9 positions that are going to go to the data center.
What happened is that
the same or are those different?
Well, what happened is that when you looked at the operations area where these are the folks that generally manage the equipment in the computer room, there's over 20 of them, and they all wear multiple hats. For example, if we look at our email system, the same person that manages our email system also assists with the wide area network, or he'll do some other functions. Mm-hmm. So there was a percentage of everyone. When we totaled those percentages, it added up to 9 positions. That included a percentage small from other divisions that also have some type of technology support within their areas. So what we've done is we basically started looking at and working with HR. If somebody had a large portion of their percentage that was in scope, well, then we moved them over and added so that they were full-time. And we've identified, obviously 9. We have had 3 people that have left because of this, and we have been working with the other staff.
But there were some members of staff that will be offered the opportunity to move to the data center.
Yes, sir. In fact, we've had several that have stepped up to say that they recognize it as an opportunity. I mean, when you're looking at an IBM Northrop Grumman and you're looking at right. them offering you a 1-year comparable pay and you're going to be in there doing the job, and if you do a good job, as far as career opportunities, there's some of our younger folks that have taken a look at that. And for us, honestly, that we hate to lose some of the folks that are there. We've had them for so long, and some of them have this institutional knowledge that when a system really breaks, and and for IT, it's one of those, if everything works, nobody really even knows we're around, we kind of like it that way. But when it doesn't, they're looking for you. And these guys have worked on this so long, they know how to go in, they know these systems. And so for us, that's been one of the risks, but it's really going to help us on the transition and when we roll over to the transformation. We really need those folks to be part of that team so that they know how to manage our system. So for us, it really is a win-win. We've encouraged that and we've worked with them on that.
Are all other agencies going into this?
Just the 27 that I showed you. They're the top 27 agencies.
Short list.
And short list.
Yeah.
27.
God, how many are there?
No, for this round, it impacts the top 27 agencies that obviously had the higher number of associated costs with data center services. And I think we really just squeaked in. I was really working to see what we could do to...
Yeah, that'd be the second round.
Yeah.
I assume you've got to be worried about this because you the time frames you're showing there
we're
short.
We are very, very concerned about this, folks. We know that we operate a very, very efficient, a very, very lean operation. We know what other agencies do. We know the number of staff they have and the amount of money that they spend. We compare very well. We probably are not going to save money here. We are doing everything we can. Mr. Rios and his staff have done an incredible job of working through this. It is not easy. It's not much fun. I serve on the board, a very similar board, as an ex officio member at the Department of Information Resources. I have expressed my concern about overpromise and underdelivery. Now, that's not fair in a way because we've got to give them a shot and they're working at it very hard, but it's a difficult transition in the agency and one that we're concerned about. We'll get there.
Let me ask one question that you made in a statement a moment ago. We're not going to know what this is actually going to cost us until the day that we sign the contract?
No, they're working through negotiation processes now and really the financial piece of it has been held with NDR and their contracts there. There are agency representatives that there was a financial work group that had agency representatives from CFO level and throughout, but we really won't know the cost until they're closer to signing the negotiation. Right now, they're waiting for the best and final to come in, which is due in October, and hopefully we'll hear something more in the November timeframe.
What if it blows our budget? I mean, what if it comes in real high? We just got to suck up and go.
We'll adjust and keep moving.
Okay.
Will there be any possibility within these agencies to have, you know, you're going to have a total expense for all the entities involved? Is there any way to blend the cost or prorate the cost out so that maybe someone else could pick up a little bit more of it?
To be seen.
I think that's been on some of the discussions as well.
Mark, it's kind of like when you, hire someone to build your commercial building. You know, you negotiate on the front end and then you negotiate on the back end.
And also private structures too.
Well, on the procedural
end. The house.
On the procedural impact, we've already implemented some of the processes that allow us to procure most of our IT-related items and services through the DR contract. Basically, it's just the continued coordination with the divisions on technology spending and projects, and really removing from where we used to buy assets and install them ourselves to pay for services, and we'll continue to work that out as we move through this process. Next step really is for us to stay involved within the project, which we've been doing. And define our strategy for delivery of services to minimize the impact on this agency and then to keep you updated. Thank you. This presentation.
Any questions or comments for Rios?
Well, this brings us to the second item, and this is the one where I have a little bit more concerns about my ongoing employment with this agency. So come up.
Good morning, I'm Ann Bright, General Counsel, and hopefully this one will be a little bit more positive and interesting, maybe even exciting. Over the last several years, staff in the executive office and communications and IT have been working to try to make the commission process, the process of having these meetings, more efficient, transparent, and user-friendly for the commissioners and for the members of the public. The use of the internet has assisted a lot in this, and one of the things you probably already know is that we actually have agendas from old commission meetings on our website back to, I think it's November of 97. We've got transcripts of previous commission meetings back to November of 99, all available right now on the commission, on the agenda, on the website. Right now, we post agendas and the related materials, which you all get in a booklet. I see a few of these around. We post those at least 12 days before the commission meeting, which, you know, our statutory deadline is only 7 days. So, again, we're trying to get as much information out there as possible. Recently, we added another feature, which is audio transcripts, so that an audio transcript of a meeting is available on the website within a few days after the commission meeting. So if you want to hear exactly what was said at a commission meeting, you don't have to wait for the court reporter to transcribe the meeting. You also don't have to wait to get a copy of the tape. So now we're ready to move on to the next stage. Beginning in November, we are planning to further automate the commission process. We're going to have a dual system, and George Rios in IT, as well as communications, have been working on this, and I'm going to let him take it from here.
Sure. I think for the November meeting, what we planned on doing is what we wanted to do is roll out with the meeting with sending the book hard copy like you currently get, which what you'll do is this time you'll receive a CD with it, and you'll also receive instructions on the CD. It'll basically be the same information that's in the book, which will be included in there, will be the transcripts from the old meeting. During the commission day, what we'll have is a laptop for each of the commissioners, and we'll be on there. It will be preloaded with the same information that's there. The difference is that this is more of a point-and-click navigation similar to what you would do on the Internet, but we'll have staff here that morning, and we'll have staff here through the meeting to ensure that we can help you. But basically, that's going to be the way we're going to try to roll out. After that meeting, we'll go back and reassess how that worked and see what we need to do, the adjustments for the January meeting.
Will that be committee and meeting?
Yes, sir.
But we'll have laptops.
So we'll have laptops. So what we're doing to reduce costs on that is we're actually using our laptops that we take out in the field for training to help reduce travel costs. We'll be using those same laptops, so really there's no additional.
So the links there, so if you're referencing a statute or a reg,
actually, it's not going to be set up so that you can surf the internet, basically. Not that you would, but...
My question is, if you reference a reg, or you reference a statute...
Whatever is in your book will be available with point and click.
I think they're looking at hyperlinking everything that's there.
Would it have keyword search? So if you want to look up flounder for the last 2 years, we can pull that...
Probably not during the meeting.
But at some stage, we might lead toward that capability.
That's one of the things we definitely would do. One of the things that...
I think that'd be great.
Having something connected to the Internet in connection with the regs, for example, is that rather than our staff having to go in and basically adjust all of our regs, we can just link to the Texas Register, which is really the primary source for that information. The same thing with the administrative code. But I just want to make sure that you understand that the availability is not going to be everything on the Internet. It's going to be the stuff really that...
Make sure that they can't email one another while you're talking.
Not that
have to do the notes.
Would it also include the slides and the charts?
And I think that's where we said that what we'll do is start reassessing, get feedback from everybody, and see that we can include or not include. They will be standalone for this.
Because sometimes you may want to refer back to a chart, and you could do it while the whoever's addressing the commission is still here, and say, well, back on the chart 2, for example.
And that's, you know, as we go through this, we'll be looking for feedback on ways to improve this process. This is just our first stab at it. And also, we're going to have a dual system, so you will still get your book. You'll still have everything you get now, so that it's a little bit more gradual.
Transition.
Very exciting.
I think it's a great idea. It'll take a meeting or two or three to get
George has been very good about having
that. We'll get there, and I think it'll be a great step. You know, I'll take you back just a couple of 3 years, and I want to particularly thank this lady right over here, Carol Hemby, has done just a tremendous job in assisting all of us in getting there. 4 years ago, June, we used to print 80-something copies of that book. Our goal is to... I mean, you can imagine how many trees that was and how much of it went to waste and the amount of time and pruning cost it took. And we're basically eliminating all that, making it available to you sooner. I can remember the days when those books got to commissioners literally almost as they walked in the door. And that's just, that's something that we can do better on. And so as we go through this process, and, you know, one of the things, I'm anxious to see how it works, because I think as you go through those agendas, for example, it'll be good if we have a note section, whereas you're looking at, if you have something that you want to be sure and remember to ask about or to get more information on, that you can make a note right there that is saved in, you know, somewhere in the process. And
it will be followed up by staff, so absolutely, that we don't ask absolutely the same question three meetings in a row.
Right. Very good.
And I was going to suggest in that connection, of course, we do this in trial work, but if you leave like a little margin on the left, like an inch and inch and a half, that's where you can put your note and it relates to that item. That's the way I do it. I'm not saying we need to do it that way, but if you just leave a little margin, you just make a note.
Along the same line, is this also where you address the issue? Some people have mentioned that the agenda is not as easily accessible on our Parks and Wildlife website as it might be. You do have to go searching for it. You really have to.
I mean, one of the things we can work out with our web folks is putting a link. I think once it goes up, usually there's a link on the far right side, kind of like, you know, Hot Topics, to the current one. You know, that's one of the things we can definitely work with communications on is making
Could you all work on that and just give us a report? Because it ought to be just front and center right there if we're 2 weeks out from meeting. When somebody goes to our website, that shouldn't be hard to find.
How would you handle the attachments, for example, like we have you'd have a regulation and with the attachments there?
What it would probably look like, again, and we're still kind of working out exactly the appearance, is you would get, you know, your screen would essentially be the agenda, and you would click on, for example, regs, and then within regs there would be the items, and then you could click on,
yeah, like exhibit A, you just hit exhibit A,
at item one, and it would have a description of that plus any attachments, if there are rules, whatever, they would all be there.
That's good. That's great.
Well, it's going to be an interesting process. November meeting will be exciting. Thank you very much. That's a great project.
Thank you.
No action required on that. Item number four, super combination license rules, stamp revenue allocation. Gene, it's kind of the black box of allocation. Hey, maybe you can help them with allocating the cost to this data center.
That's a whole other thing. Chairman, Commissioners, my name is Gene McCarty. For the record, my name is Gene McCarty. The item before you today deals with the allocation of net receipts from the sale of the Super Combo license. As you may remember, in the recent audit of Fund 9, the State Auditor's Office recommended that the Commission define net receipts in the methodology it uses to allocate revenue from the Super Combo licenses to dedicated stamp funds and allocate revenues accordingly. In addition, it was recommended that the Commission define net receipts from any other combination license for which the full amount of the stamp is not allocated to a restricted fund. And just for your information, the only other license is the Senior Super Combo, so we're working with both the Super Combo and the Senior Super Combo. At your May Commission meeting, you authorized staff to publish a proposed administrative rule in the Texas Register that would define and allocate net receipts for the Super Combo license components of both licenses and stamps as a value calculated from the weight from a relative weighting using both the price of the stamp or the license and the purchaser use as established by a dedicated survey. This rule was published in the July 21st, 2006 issue of the Texas Register, and to date we've received no public comment. Also, As discussed in the May Commission meeting, the department has conducted a dedicated survey of super combo and senior super combo buyers to determine license and stamp usage. And what you see here is the results to date of that survey. We've only got one mailing out right now. We've got recently, last week, sent a second mailing out just as a reminder. We've gotten just on a single mail out, we've gotten an extremely good response rate, about 35% in the super combo and over 60% in the senior super combo in terms of individuals responding to our mail out. So we feel pretty confident in this data. It's even going to get better. We'll probably
sit
and pull a plug on it in a couple of weeks and do our allocations. It's interesting to note the difference between super combo and senior super combo. It would appear to me that purchasers of the senior super combo are really purchasing that license as a value license as compared to the regular combo, which is purchased as a convenience license. When these results are applied to the actual revenues from the FY06 super combo, you get this kind of an allocation. Just for comparative reference, I've also included the fund allocation schedule based on our 2005 methodology. If you remember, our old methodology was based on a series of a lot of different surveys, fish and wildlife survey of users, small games harvest for Texas Parks and Wildlife Division. A lot of different survey data was all blended together to create an allocation. We didn't miss it by too far, I don't think. There's a little bump here and there. I think probably the place that we missed it the most is in archers, in archery hunters, using the percentage of archery hunters that are actually using the super combo. Based on the super combo survey results and comments received from in-house reviews, we are proposing an amended administrative rule. The amendments are intended to just simply clarify and simplify the rule and provide for full utilization of all this data. And we would be requesting your consideration to present this to full commission tomorrow for final adoption. Any questions?
Will you survey annually?
Okay. We will survey every year. Over time we'll get an idea of any movement within groups, any change in utilization. It's interesting to look at the difference between people who are utilizing the super combo to fish or utilizing the super combo to hunt. Those numbers are slightly lower than what we would have expected. However, the other interesting component of it is looking at freshwater and saltwater stamp. The amount of overlap there is higher than we would have expected. So there's a lot of interesting data here, and we'll be mining it for a good while.
We'll get you a full report on this when we get our numbers in, but we wanted to give you this preliminary because we think it's going to change very little with that kind of turn. But a really good statistical, valid samples, methodology being used here, and the guys have done a great job.
Just one quick question that I have, Gene. The numbers, the percentage return on these surveys is stunningly high, like 10x higher than you would normally expect. How many did you send out? You didn't send out to everyone that had a...
No, sir. It was a,
you,
it was
you
a
had
random
selected
sample.
A random sample,
of 5,000 to be.
It's still amazing. It's amazing.
People care about the children.
Super combo buyers are premier user group.
Yeah. Well, that's a qualified, very qualified group. Yeah. Super combo is paying the premium.
That's interesting. They want us to know.
They want us to know. Yeah.
Right. Now, does that include the life? That wouldn't include the life.
No, that doesn't include the lifetime license.
That's another dedicated group.
Even the premier user group.
Right.
Are there any further questions, comments for Gene? Thank you very much. If there are no further questions or discussion, I will place this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Mr. Cook?
I believe that's it, sir. That's it. In the interest of some items that require action, we have requested that we move to...